The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So tonight I'd like to talk about mindfulness and awareness and how we pay attention to our experience. When we begin meditating, when we start our meditation practice, our mindfulness practice, typically we're given the instruction to pay attention to the breathing or to stabilize the mindfulness on a particular experience, something that we can stay with for a while so that we get familiar with what it's like to be mindful. We get familiar with what it's like to pay attention. We get familiar with what it's like for our minds to wander off and what it's like to wake up into that wandering off. And over time, as we get familiar with that feeling of being mindful, it's as we get to the place where we understand how to be present. Because initially when we start out, sometimes it's not so clear when we're present and when we're not. And the mind wanders off, and pretty much that we know, at least initially when we start meditating, that we're not paying attention because we're not paying attention to the thing we said we'd pay attention to. We've set our intention to pay attention to breathing, and we know that we've lost track of our mindfulness because we notice that we're thinking or we're not paying attention to the breathing. And so we begin to get a sense of familiarity with what it feels like to be present, what it feels like to be aware, through this cultivating the attention on something in particular, like the breathing, or perhaps like hearing. And over time, as we get familiar with that, we can start to loosen up on the focus on a particular object of experience and begin to allow more aspects of our experience to come into the mindfulness practice so that we're not thinking that paying attention or being mindful means just paying attention to the breathing. The mindfulness practice is ultimately a very open awareness practice that allows any experience to be known. Anything at all that we experience can be known with mindfulness. So when you're sitting here meditating and you're paying attention to your breathing, you might at some point notice that your mind kind of is automatically pulled to the sound of a car that goes by, or a motorcycle, or the sound of somebody moving in the room. That's not a problem with mindfulness practice if you can recognize that the mind has been pulled to this new thing and just pay attention to that. So, for instance, during the guided meditation, we were paying attention to hearing at the beginning. So we can be mindful of hearing. We can be mindful of breathing. We can be mindful of vibration in our body. We can be mindful of itching, of heat, of coolness, of lightness. We can be mindful of dryness. We can be mindful of moods and emotions. So mindfulness doesn't need to be restricted to any one thing in particular. And as we get more familiar with the meditation practice, we can let go of that focus on the breathing and allow ourselves to recognize what the mind is kind of naturally paying attention to. Sometimes this is called paying attention to what's obvious in our experience or what's predominant in our experience. And that may not be the breathing. It may be a painful knee. It may be a feeling of joy. It may be the sound of a motorcycle. So the mindfulness can take in all of these different experiences. the kind of direction of the mindfulness practice is to cultivate a steadiness of attention or a continuity of attention so that there's not a break in the awareness, that there's always mindfulness going. It just may be moving. The object might be changing. The thing, the experience that we are mindful of might be changing. We might be aware of the breath for a few moments and then the hearing for a few moments and then a feeling of coolness in our body for a few moments and then a feeling of happiness for a few moments. But the awareness is stable. The mind isn't wandering away from the present moment. There's an awareness of what's happening in the present moment. And it's just that the thing that you're aware of is changing. Kind of entering into, we enter into the flow of our existence, kind of the river of our changing experience. So we can be aware of all of these things, of what's happening in our experience. And that's not all that is needed in order to really begin to understand our minds and the way our minds work, the way we suffer, the way our habits and patterns work. If we just focus on what's happening out there, we might be missing some things that are kind of habitual ways that we see things. And they're so habitual that we don't notice that we're seeing things in a particular way. So if we're just looking at what we typically would, what's obviously predominant to us, we may be looking through some kind of a filter, a habitual filter, that we're not aware of. I've been using a prop lately. I don't remember if I've used this prop in this class. Have I used my glasses prop in this class? No. So if you are wearing sunglasses, you know, you've got this looking through the world through this lens of the sunglasses. There's a kind of a different color that you're seeing things through. And if you wear them long enough, it's kind of like you forget that you're wearing them. It's just like things become gray. Things are always that color. And it's not particularly anything unusual that things are that color. So we can be looking through things at our experience without recognizing that we've got some kind of a filter or some kind of a color that we're looking through. I'll come back to this. So last week I talked about views. I talked about letting go, and one of the things I talked about letting go of was views. And this is essentially, I'm talking about views, and essentially we have views that we see the world through that we may not recognize. And we have no idea that these views are there. So it's helpful if we can find some way to begin to uncover these views, to begin to point them out to us, to find a way to look back and reflect. Is there something I'm looking through that I'm not really conscious of? So this is looking essentially at how are we observing things? How are we experiencing the world? So there's all of the experience. There's the what that's happening. There's the vibration, the tingling, the coolness, the heat, the sound of the motorcycle, the happiness, all of the feelings and body sensations and moods and emotions that are going on that we can pay attention to. And there there may be some way that we are some way that we are looking through some filter and seeing that experience colored through some lens. Essentially how we are looking at our experience. What we are looking at, the object that we're actually paying attention to, whether we're paying attention to breathing or hearing or emotion or vibration or tingling or coolness or dryness, what we're paying attention to is not so important. In the meditation, in the mindfulness practice, however, how we pay attention is crucially important. So beginning to look at how we're relating to our experience. How are we relating to what's happening? And actually, it is largely in this relationship to our experience that's where our suffering happens. That's where suffering lies. That's where our stress lies, our frustration, our irritation, our annoyance. It lies in our relationship to our experience. This is not just in meditation. This is in our daily lives as well. So starting to ask ourselves, how do we relate to our experience? One of my teachers, my Burmese teachers, Sayadaw Utejaniya, has a technique that he suggests for exploring this, how we're relating to our experience. And it's very simple. It's very, very simple. Basically, he says, ask yourself, how am I relating to my experience? So really that simple. What's my attitude? My teacher Utejaniya calls this relationship that we have to our experience our attitude about the experience. So he has that as a shorthand. What's my attitude? Or what's my relationship to my experience? Any of those ways of exploring this as a question. So in my experience of working with this question of what's my attitude, I find it most helpful to not try to figure out what, not to think about it, let's say. So, you know, asking this kind of a question can tend to lead us to start to think about things, but that's not the intention here. It's not the intention to think about what your relationship to your experience is. It's kind of to open yourself to the possibility that there might be something that you hadn't noticed in your experience. So, you know, you're sitting there looking through some kind of colored lens and looking at your experience, and you may not even think of asking yourself how you're relating to your experience. And finally, if you do think about asking that question, well, what's my attitude here? It might suddenly become very obvious. Oh, I'm looking through this lens of aversion. I don't like what's happening. Whereas it hadn't been so clear to you that that aversion was happening. You were just kind of hanging out with this itch on your body. It's like, yep, I'm hanging out with that itch. I'm feeling it. I'm being with it. And there's a kind of a gritting your teeth to, grrr, I'm not going to move, I'm not going to scratch it. And we're not noticing that part of it. And just asking the question, well, what's my attitude about this itch? What's my relationship to that itch? It can open our door to just saying, oh, it's really obvious. It's so obvious that I don't like this itch. But that hadn't been noticed. So essentially, we're talking about a movement here of moving from the place where we're looking through this attitude of aversion to the itch. When we notice that we have this attitude of aversion, we have the possibility of now, rather than looking through this lens of aversion, to take them off and look at them. So our mind is no longer colored by this attitude of aversion. Instead, it becomes the thing that we are paying attention to. So it's a movement from looking through that to looking at it. It gives us a little bit of a distance to it. So when exploring this kind of a question, if you're paying attention to an itch and you check in and go, okay, what's my attitude? And then you notice this feeling of aversion. The movement at this point is to turn the attention to the aversion, to look at the aversion, to not try to keep paying attention to the itch, because actually the aversion is what's happening. The aversion is the main thing that's going on in the mind. So that movement to check in, ask what is going on, and then if you find something obvious, rather than trying to keep looking at the thing, you were looking through this attitude, rather than trying to keep looking at the thing out there that you were looking at, look instead at the attitude itself directly. This is a very powerful movement in our practice. A very powerful way to begin to uncover some of these hidden views, these hidden agendas, attitudes, beliefs that we have, just by asking this question. One way I like to think about this question of what's my attitude, again, to not try to figure it out, to not try to find the answer, I like to think about it almost like the asking the question is like ringing a doorbell. You're ringing the doorbell, and then you're sitting back and waiting and seeing what comes. What answers the doorbell? What responds? So you just ask the question, what's my attitude? What's my relationship to my experience? And see whether there's something obvious that happens. Something obvious that is made obvious to you. Sometimes when we ask that question, it's glaringly obvious, actually, that there is this relationship that we have to our experience that we hadn't particularly noticed. Sometimes when you check in like this, asking yourself, well, what's my attitude about my experience? What's my relationship to my experience? There isn't particularly anything obvious. There's not particularly anything that stands out. And that is not a problem. Sometimes there's usually some kind of attitude going on, but sometimes it's more subtle. So it's not a problem. If you check in and ask yourself the question, what's my attitude? And you don't particularly find one, don't try to create one. Just go back to paying attention to what you were paying attention to before: the breathing, the vibration, the experience of hearing, bodily sensation, emotion, whatever you is obvious to you. Just keep track of whatever's obvious to you. And check in every now and then during your meditation, what's my relationship to my experience? At some point, there'll be something very clear. So you don't need to try to stop and think, well, I don't know. Well, is it this? Is it this? Just let it go. If there's not something obvious, there's nothing that you need to worry about. Just check in every now and then. You will at some point see perhaps something obvious, and that thing will probably have roughly one of four different qualities to it. It will either be a relationship of wanting something to happen, wanting to have something, wanting to hold on to something. It'll be a relationship of not wanting, of aversion, of wanting to get rid of something, to push something away. It'll be a relationship of delusion, of confusion, of unclarity. Or it'll be a relationship of balance of mind. It's possible that the attitude can be one of a balanced mind. Often when I talk about this, and the term attitude itself, I think, tends to bring up this idea that it's an attitude that's got some kind of something's wrong about it. But the attitude of meditation can be one of balance of mind. You might check in and just notice that there's a sense of ease and balance of mind around what's happening. That's fine. That is what my Burmese teacher calls right attitude. When our attitude is balanced around what we are observing, then the meditation is not colored by greed, aversion, or delusion. So we're paying attention in a way that is balanced. So I'll talk a little bit about each of these, the greed, the aversion, and the delusion. The balance of mind is just a sense of calmness, of peace, of... there might be a sense, if you're observing something, particularly if you're observing something difficult or unpleasant, if there's a sense that, I don't mind this, that's balance of mind. If your relationship to that experience is, I don't mind this, that's a sense of balance of mind. Now, if the relationship has this feeling of, oh, I don't care, there's probably a little bit of aversion going on with that. That the I don't care tends to have a little bit of a feeling of pushing away, a little bit of a feeling of something is off. So seeing these attitudes, just checking in, noticing these attitudes, there can be many different levels of obviousness and subtlety to these attitudes as you check in to your relationship, to your experience. So for instance, with greed, wanting things to be a particular way. And it might be completely, completely obvious. It's like, oh yes, this is right. This is the way it's supposed to be. If that's the relationship to the experience, I want this to continue. This feels really good. There's that movement of wanting. It might be a little more subtle. It might be a sense of anticipation or expectation or amusement. Those qualities of mind have a little bit of wanting to them. There might be a little bit of a leaning in to the experience, just a wanting to know or a wanting to understand, just a subtle feeling of leaning in. The not wanting also has these gradations, these different levels of whether of obviousness to subtlety. It might be completely obvious, as the example I gave a few minutes ago about paying attention to an itch, and it's just like, oh, I can't stand this. So really clearly obvious that the attitude is one of not liking, not wanting, wanting to get rid of. It might be a little more subtle. It might be just a subtle sense of discontent or annoyance. Or even a sense of boredom can come out of a little bit of aversion. It might have the sense, there might be a subtle feeling with the aversive quality. Usually when we're paying attention to something unpleasant, that's a good time to check in to see if there's anything aversive going on. Unpleasantness tends to lead to aversion. And often what happens with people as they meditate and as they get more and more familiar with how the meditation proceeds, there'll be this subtle attitude around unpleasant experience, something along the lines of, if I pay attention to this properly, it will go away. And that's a subtle kind of aversive attitude. So in our paying attention to our experience, checking in. What's my relationship? What's my relationship to my experience? There's this unpleasant experience. What's my relationship to it? Oh, I must not be paying attention to it quite right, or else it'll go away. Just that subtle sense of I'm not doing something right being an attitude of aversion. The attitude of delusion is a little more complex. It's got two basic flavors to it. It's kind of got the flavor of not knowing, of uncertainty, of confusion, of disconnection from experience. Boredom actually is often a manifestation of delusion because there's a disconnection from experience with boredom. There's just this little sense of not being with experience. So delusion has that quality of not connecting, of not engaging, of just checking out, of kind of spacing out. So that's one way that delusion manifests. It's through this kind of spacing out quality. So you're paying attention and you paying attention to something and you check into your attitude and it's kind of got this drifty, spacey quality. Maybe need a little bit more attention to connecting with experience. Just bringing the attention in a little more close to the experience. But the more pervasive and difficult, essentially, aspect of delusion is, and pernicious in a way, it's so subtle, is that delusion also comes about through a distorted perception. Again, through this not seeing that we're looking through some kind of a filter. And not necessarily a greedy filter or an aversive filter, but just a filter that is assuming that things are a certain way when it's not actually true. So for example, I'm not going to go into a lot of detail on all the various ways that this happens. But for example, there's one major delusion that we live with is assuming permanence. That we impute permanence to a lot of our experience. We impute permanence to things. We kind of assume things are going to be around. Now we know intellectually that things are impermanent. We definitely know this intellectually. We know that everything is going to, decay and age and eventually fall apart. But that's not really the way we relate to it. That's not the way we actually relate to our experience. For example, this is kind of maybe something you've experienced. We get to know our friends, and they get to know us. And there's kind of familiar ways that they engage with things. You get to know the ways they react to things. You get to know how they do things. And after a while of knowing somebody, you kind of just begin to assume that that's the way they are. And that we kind of put them in a box and it's like, okay, that's them. They're like that. So we kind of impute this sense of, yeah, that person is always late. That person is always getting frustrated. So we give them that quality, we kind of put it on them and give it a sense of permanence to them. That's the way they are. I think most of us have had the sense of being on the receiving end of that and knowing, feeling boxed in by that, feeling that it's not true. It's not true. I'm more than that. I'm more flexible than that. I'm not always that way. So the way we behave with the world, the way we behave with our the way we behave with the things we experience in the world, is that we tend to see the patterns in the world and give permanence to those patterns. Even if intellectually we know it's not true, that's the way we operate. And that's like that view. So that view, when we operate in that way and we're seeing things, so we're seeing our friend doing these things, we're not giving them the room to behave differently. You know, even if they behave differently, it's like that information doesn't come in because we've got this filter on. We've got this view on that person behaves that way. So we see the confirmation of that. And we don't so much see the things that don't confirm that. So that's the kind of perniciousness of delusion. That because we're looking through a particular filter, we take in information that confirms that view, and we don't take in information that doesn't confirm that view. So this one can be very challenging to see through. Essentially, this is partly where the wisdom teachings of the Buddha begin to point out to us these are common ways that people delude themselves. We take things to be permanent. We take things to be happiness that are actually counterproductive to happiness, our ultimate happiness. We take things to be self that have no aspect of self. Everything's just a flow, but we kind of put a box around something. That's me, that's mine. We take things to be beautiful that are actually not so beautiful. So the teachings help to point us to some of these delusions, and then we can kind of look at what we're experiencing and think, okay, how am I relating to this? Is there some of that delusion? This may not be something that we can necessarily see. You know, it's not that's this kind of attitude, this kind of delusional attitude, isn't something that's quite so obvious to us in terms of just checking in to say, oh, what's my attitude? Oh, I'm taking this to be permanent. That doesn't happen so often. It's much more that we begin to get to the place where we can be more continuous with our mindfulness. The mindfulness gets to be to where we can stay present for this unchanging flow of experience. And what happens to us is that the assumption of permanence is pointed out to us when we see something disappear. We're paying attention to something, and there's a way that, you know, we're just paying attention to that thing, and suddenly we notice when it vanishes. And in that noticing when it vanishes, we recognize in that moment, wow, that thing's gone. And we realize that a moment before we had given it that view of permanence. It's kind of in the insight into impermanence that we begin to see the delusion. And it's the continuity of the awareness that begins to reveal these delusional views. So I'm telling you about these, you know, these delusional views more as an information. That's not something we can really choose to change our perception around. It's something more we just have to investigate our experience. And over time, we may start to see how we were clinging to something as being permanent. When it disappears, we'll see, oh, wow, that's gone. It's kind of surprising when these insights come. It's a surprise when we see something vanish. Having this experience of watching wanting, observing wanting, feeling the feeling in the body, just watching it, and then watching it fall apart in an instant. when the conditions that were holding that wanting into place fall apart. It's kind of surprising. So there's some particularly helpful times to check attitude, some particularly helpful times to look into this. I'm just going to give you a couple of them, because this technique is actually very powerful, but it's also not one you want to just sit there continually applying. You know, if you're sitting in meditation, you don't want to continually say, well, what's my relationship to that? What's my relationship to that? It kind of goes into this infinite regress. And it can be not so helpful to just continually ask yourself that question. But from time to time, it's a very helpful question to check into, both in meditation and in our daily lives. We're finding one of the times that's really helpful to check in is when we're finding there's a sense of tension or struggle or conflict happening. In your sitting meditation, if you're paying attention to your breathing and there's a feeling of like trying, a sense of struggle or tension around that, that's a really good time to check in. What's my attitude about this? What's my relationship to the breathing? Oh, there's a sense that I have to stay with the breathing. So there's this movement of clinging to it. Or in your daily life, you're dealing with something in your kitchen and finding yourself getting really frustrated, that's a good time to check in. What's my attitude about this? What's my attitude about this? It can begin to uncover like hidden beliefs that we have. I'm supposed to be able to know how to do this. The frustration is coming out of this belief that I'm supposed to be able to know something. Maybe not. So checking in when there's some kind of tension or struggle, it's a really helpful time to check your attitude. Another good time to check into the attitude is when you remember that you've forgotten to be mindful. So that moment when you wake up in meditation, you're paying attention to the breath and your mind wanders off and you remember, you wake up into the wandering mind and you realize, oh, right, I was trying to be paying attention to my breath. That's another really good time to check in to the attitude. Check in to see what has been the impact of that wandering on your experience. I've seen two rough different flavors of this. That sometimes when the mind wanders off, if it gets caught in some kind of a story, if it's wandering off into some kind of a, you know, argument or frustration or something like that, then as we come back into the present moment, there can be a lingering flavor of that argument in the present moment. So there's a sense that there's been an impact on the mind and body from that way the mind had wandered off. It had wandered into this frustrating space, and coming back into the present moment, that quality of frustration is still there. So checking into that, recognizing that as an attitude. It's just something that's arising, not something you need to get rid of, not something that you need to fix. It's much more this movement of seeing if you can move from looking through it to looking at it. Sometimes when we wake up after wandering off in meditation, there's a completely different relationship that happens. Sometimes the mind has just kind of drifted off. It's just kind of drifting. It's more like there's not so much energy holding the meditation together. So there's just been a drifting off of the mind. Sometimes when I wake up into that kind of a situation, there's actually a greater relaxation. That there's, it's kind of like that drifting has allowed the mind to relax a little bit more. And so noticing, actually recognizing that that has been the impact of the wandering on the experience is very helpful. What's my attitude? Well, there's actually some relaxation and ease that's come in. Another place to check the attitude that's really helpful time to check the attitude is when you feel like things are going really well, whether in your sitting meditation or in your daily life. You're sitting in meditation and it's like completely present. You're right there. Check in. What's the attitude? What's my attitude? Very often when things are going well, there's a subtle kind of clinging. And sometimes not so subtle. Sometimes it's like, I want more of this. This is good. Thank you. This is what I've been waiting for, finally. So sometimes there can be a sense of a really clearly seeing that attitude of wanting. Sometimes it's a little more subtle. It's just kind of like, oh, this is what it's supposed to be like. So when things are going well is another good time to check in with this question. What's my attitude? So the way that this actually supports us in terms of becoming more and more awake and more free is that this question of checking the attitude begins to show us how our minds work. It begins to point out to us our habits, our patterns, our tendencies in our minds. Things that we don't typically see. They're so close to us, they're like the air we breathe. We live with these patterns and habits, so we don't recognize them so much. This checking the attitude begins to point these out to us, and we begin to recognize that they're in the way of seeing clearly. We actually begin to recognize that these patterns and habits are a large part of what contributes to our suffering. So this pathway of checking into the attitude, at first it starts to reveal really obvious clinging, really obvious suffering. I hate this. This is great. And as we go further and further, we start to see that this question can begin to reveal even much more subtle kinds of clinging, things that we would not have known were there unless we took the time to check, ask this question. It's like we have all these different veils in front of our eyes. And each time we check into the attitude, it's like we're opening another veil. We're still looking through multiple veils. But there's a little more clarity. And then we check some more, and there's a little more clarity. So over time, this very simple technique helps us to see and get to the place where we can see very clearly without greed, aversion, or delusion. Just imagine, think of what would it be like to live in the world, to live with the feeling everything's okay the way it is, to not want to have to change or fix or alter anything. To me, when I make that reflection, there's a kind of a feeling of, whew, boy, that would be nice. To not have to do, fix, change. So that movement takes us closer to clarity and freedom from suffering. So we have some time for some questions, and I want to first check in and see if there's anything in the room. I have a couple in the bowl tonight, a couple of questions in the bowl. Okay, I'll go with one of these. So this question is, how do you move beyond an intellectual understanding of the hindrances or any Buddhist teaching to a deeper knowing? I find that intellectual understanding works fine until challenged, then is vulnerable to my mental lawyers who are adept at arguing why a teaching doesn't apply this time. So how do we move beyond an intellectual understanding to an actual experiential understanding in our practice? It has to do with mindfulness, essentially, you know, what I've been talking about this evening, this bringing our attention to our experience. We use the teachings as a kind of a framework through which to observe experience. So, for instance, the teaching on the Four Noble Truths isn't simply something that's meant to be thought about, the teaching that there is suffering, there's a cause of suffering, there's a cessation of suffering, there's a path leading to the cessation of suffering. It's not simply something to be believed and thought about. It's meant to be applied in our experience. So we engage in our practice with the teachings as a kind of a guide or a pointer to what to pay attention to. So, for example, tonight I was talking about greed, aversion, and delusion, talking about those qualities. And that there's a very strong teaching, there's a strong Buddhist teaching around greed, aversion, and delusion being the way that we suffer. Essentially, when greed, aversion, and delusion arise in the mind, that's how we suffer. That's the pathway towards suffering, when we respond and react out of greed, aversion, and delusion. So the teaching about that isn't meant to just simply sit there in our minds and go, oh, greed, aversion, and delusion leads to suffering. It's meant to point us to observe our suffering and to observe how it's coming into being. So to bring our attention to our experience and look at when we're suffering and what is contributing to that suffering. So this teaching tonight around looking at the attitude, you know, just that teaching I just gave around when you're struggling, when you're suffering, check into the attitude. So you're sitting there struggling with the breathing. Check into the attitude. It may reveal to you a hidden aversion that was underneath that you hadn't noticed. So the mindfulness is really the way that we begin to understand the truth of these teachings. We start with a kind of an intellectual understanding through hearing the teachings, but they're not going to go anywhere or do anything for us until we actually begin to observe our experience. And as we begin to observe our experience, we start to see, oh, when this happens, when I'm reacting out of aversion, I suffer. So we clearly begin to see the link. We clearly begin to understand and know that link. Now, in this question that this person says, I find an intellectual understanding works fine until challenged, then is vulnerable to my mental lawyers, who are adept at arguing why a teaching doesn't apply this time. That sounds like doubt. That sounds like basically a part of the mind that has got some other idea that it's trying to promote. So a kind of a habit of believing that things work in a certain way. So what I like to suggest for doubt, at least for myself, when I come into doubt about the teachings, doubt about the teachers, one of the key teachings that I connect to, that the Buddha taught, is this teaching that not to just believe what I say, but try it. So when I run up against this kind of doubt, I remind myself, well, the Buddha didn't ask me to believe this. He asked me to check it out. So using mindfulness to run the experiment. So about, for instance, paying attention to the hindrances as opposed to being acting out of them. When anger arises, rather than acting out of anger, turning the attention to feeling what is the experience of anger. That's the instruction around that experience of anger, to turn the attention to anger. Now, the mental lawyers may start going, well, that's not a good idea. It's really important for me to fix this thing and do this thing and get rid of this problem here. When I run into that kind of doubt, I say to myself, well, the Buddha didn't ask me to believe him. He asked me to run the experiment. I'm just going to run the experiment and see what happens. See what happens if I turn my attention to the anger instead of acting on it. So that's one suggestion about working with those mental lawyers that this person describes. Just run the experiment. See if you can. You don't have to shove the mental lawyers aside. Just tell them, well, let's wait a moment. Let's gather some data here and see what this teaching does. Let's just give it a try. See how that works. I could say more about that, but I think I'll stop there and see if there's anyone else who has any questions. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You said the goal of mindfulness is to get rid of aversion, delusion, and attachment, and to be okay with the way things are. However, in order to maintain our living, we have to strive after things in order to keep on going in life. Like, we have to go to school, we have to do a good performance in our work, and so on. So I'm wondering, can you be okay with the way things are and at the same time pursue goals like graduating from college and getting a house or whatever else?
This is a very common way that the teachings seem to be understood to be, well, I'm not supposed to do anything. I'm just supposed to sit here and accept things as they are and just let them wash over me. There's no way to act. The teaching is about letting go of acting out of greed, aversion, and delusion, and to move towards acting out of kindness, generosity, wisdom, compassion, positive movement. So the key is really around looking at how are our actions motivated? Is there a motivation of aversion or greed, or is there a motivation of wisdom? Is there a motivation of compassion, of generosity, of kindness? So that's the direction that we're trying to head, is towards those more wholesome motivations for our actions. And it's challenging. As we move in our lives, we're going to see that there are mixed motivations. Yes, I'm going to college because I want to get a good job, and there's some amount of greed to that. But there's also this sense of wanting to contribute to the world and make the world a better place, a sense of wanting to help people. So we're going to see mixed motivations. And the teaching is to become really familiar with those mixed motivations, to see which aspects are not so helpful and which ones are more skillful, which ones are more productive towards happiness and freedom. So we should probably stop. I apologize for this other question that I didn't get to. I'll save it. So I would like to thank you all for your practice and your attention and your engagement with the teachings. And may your time over the next few months be productive and valuable. May you be happy and healthy and safe and at ease during these next few months.